You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beej, the optimistic newbie developer. Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we're talking about cognitive biases. These are biases that we have that prevent us from making good decisions. We've put together kind of a short, non-exhaustive list of some of the most common ones that we face as developers. And that includes the bandwagon effect and confirmation bias, reactance, the availability heuristic, the Dunning-Kruger effect, the curse of knowledge, the framing effect, and finally, we discuss the anchoring effect. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
I am fighting an extreme desire to clean up my server room.
As I've been sharing images of it on...
It's funny how the social pressure goes. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot of loose wires hanging out here, and I don't know, I'm not real happy with it. Like, I bought a bunch of little bitty short wires to go from the patch panel down to the switch, but I don't know if you can currently see it, but I'm not really using those yet. And, you know, that would clean up some of the mess. And then I've got like a wiring harness over here that none of the wires are in. And the thing is I'll have to shut everything down.
Even more so than when we record.
Yeah. You know, like the routers will have to be shut down, the battery backups and everything will have to go through that pipe to get plugged into the wall. And so I just haven't gotten around to it.
I completely understand. I want to move the router at my new place, and I just haven't because I'm going to have to shut down the internet and then turn it back on and make sure everything connects again.
Yeah. Cause you may move it to somewhere that it won't work. And yeah, you know, like behind where you're sitting on the wall is where I'm going to put the wireless router so that it's not inside the server rack sitting on top of the backup power supply, which is maybe not the best place for it.
Maybe not, no.
Yeah, you know, just a little Faraday cage action there for your wireless network. Not a really good idea. Kind of dumb. And to do that, I'm going to have to get a Cat6 plug dropped in here and, you know, go through all that stuff. And I don't know. I'm trying to do a little bit of the spring cleaning that I just sort of put off.
To quote one of the wisest programmers I know, don't do the dumb.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of where I am this week. I'm still pretty frustrated with a lot of stuff going on. I think a lot of it, like I deal very well with stress and then it hits me after.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm still kind of on the downswing from just a winter and a fall and a summer and a spring and a winter of just insane workloads. And now that I don't have that, of course, you know, I think, too, at some point, I'll probably just go right back to an insane workload.
Yeah, probably, because that's you.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like if I sit, like I have a very hard time just sitting and not doing anything. Yesterday, I actually played a video game for 5 hours, 6 hours, and I kept wanting to stop and go do work. But I told myself, I'm like, I'm going to take a day off and just calm down and not have to have a value judgment on that day. And that was extremely difficult. So I guess, what are you into?
I have a little bit of a statement for companies out there that are looking to hire. As everyone knows, I've been on the job hunt, and hopefully by the time this episode airs, I may or may not have a job. Hopefully I will.
Hopefully you may or may not.
Yeah, exactly. That's my logic. I'm sticking to it.
Alrighty.
Anyways, got a call on the drive here this evening, and it's not the recruiter's fault this time. This time I blame the company, and I'm not going to name the company because I'm still got an interview with them, so I don't want to mess that up. But recruiter called me, tells me he's got this great company. He describes exactly what they're looking for, and you know, it's exactly the amount of experience I have. It is the stuff that I have, like it was, you know, a year or two of .NET. They want someone that knows JavaScript jQuery, Angular. You know, it's like right up everything that I've been doing for the last 2 years. And I'm like, well, this is awesome. This is, you know, this is going right along with the two or three other jobs I've put in for that are just like that, are great fits for me. And then he tells me the name of it. And it's one I've already been submitted for that I have an interview with next week. And I felt bad. I was like, hey, I'm just going to stop you right there because I've already been submitted for this by another recruiter. And it's not his fault. Yeah. It's not like they work at the same company.
Well, that's why I typically only work with one at a time, is because I find that a lot of places tend to tell all the recruiters about what they have available, just to try to get people in the door because the market's kind of tight trying to find people.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is then the recruiters carpet bomb the developers with it. And you'll get submitted like 5 times to one company. And then they go, oh, this guy must be desperate because he's going through all these recruiters. And they look desperate to you. You look desperate to them. And the recruiters are desperate. And it's just, it's a bad network effect.
No, that's what I'm starting to see. And
plus, I'm lazy. I mean, I don't want to write down every place they submit my resume. Well, and try to keep them from crossing each other because I'm not interested in that kind of effort. You know, here is the singleton that exists in nature. You know, we said singletons don't exist in nature. Singletons do exist in nature. I have a recruiter that I go to.
She's pretty cool. I have met
and
her.
That's and
that's it. Yeah. Actually sent her an email today. Anyways. Yeah. So I, been dealing with that. I particularly remember this one because I've used the software that this company writes, and I recognized the company name the first time. And so when he said it, I was like, hey, you know, and he had another one for me. And, so I'm looking through that, but, I've had a couple of recruiters that I've talked to that are, I guess, veteran recruiters, been doing it for a while, that have given me some really great advice. And, so I'm when we do our interview episode, I'll probably share some of that advice that they've given me. The other thing I've been up to lately is, do you remember, I guess it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe longer by the time this episode comes out, you sent me, something on Twitter as a tutorial for making a game with Unity.
Yes.
So I took that tutorial and went through it.
That went into Buffer at like 2 o'clock in the morning, by the way. I know you got it in the middle of the day.
Yeah. I love Buffer. I use it all the time for the podcast stuff. But, I went through the whole thing, to be honest, and, kind of made some changes. I mean, this is the way that I learn. I go through tutorials and I make the programs my own.
Yeah.
And so I have developed a mobile game for my nephew called Bubble Pop because he loves bubbles and throwing balls and playing basketball. I mean, he's not even 2 yet, but he likes this kind of stuff. And like, who doesn't like popping bubbles? And let's be honest, I'm 35 years old and I like popping bubbles.
I would assume that Ben Bernanke doesn't like it. Sorry.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And what's funny is this may hit and everybody's like, ooh, that's just cold. Cause I mean, you know, it's probably coming.
Yeah. Wow. Anyways. So in this game, the tutorial you sent was the, is it like bug tracker where you like click on the bug and it jumps back and forth. So I just changed it to be a bubble that explodes when you hit it. And then, you know, you got to hit the next one and keep it from, you got to pop the bubbles before they hit the ground.
Okay.
And I showed it to my mom and she was just like, wow, that's really cool. I'm like, it took me an afternoon.
Yeah.
Going through that. I mean, it took that long because I went through the tutorial and then I went in and made it, you know, I made the bug I changed the background. I changed it into a bubble and I made it a menu screen and a closing screen. And then when you like click the play game.
So you're going to put it in the App Store?
Yes, I am.
Might as well.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, even if it doesn't make anything, that's something you can point to and go, yeah, I made this.
Yeah, it's going to be my first app in the App Store.
Actually, technically, I do have something in there. that I was part of. I didn't do most of it.
The only real problem I have right now is all I have is an iPhone and an iPad. I don't have a Mac to build to put it in the Apple Store, but both my sisters have iPhones.
Yeah.
So I got to either find someone that does.
We have a friend that's about to buy a Mac.
That's true, we do.
For business purposes.
Yeah, that's true.
And her husband is a developer.
Yeah.
Because this is she who shall not be named.
That's true. That's very true. I guess we can.
Maybe you can sweet talk your way into that. I don't know.
Well, we can. I can try.
We might try after the book is published and everything calms down.
Yeah, yeah.
That's when you do that. So you just chill out a little bit and then we're good. So I guess it's time to roll the music.
Let's roll that glorious music. All right, this week for IoTs, got something a bit different. This isn't a project or a product or even an R file. This is online IoT courses you should know. It's on the Internet of Things wiki. And most of these are free online courses, but they're kind of designed to be an intro to working in the Internet of Things. Great way to get started, and starts with courses for beginners, and then they have courses specific to Raspberry Pi, to Arduino. There's a prototyping course, a course on drones and robots, and even an embedded gadgets and systems set of courses. And so right now what I've got pulled up is the first page of this that talks about it, and it's the courses for beginning with the Internet of Things. You know, number one is build your own Internet of Things, and it has how to get started, setting up a Dragon Board development platform, the various technologies, and then another course on multimedia Internet of Things. They even have one on beginner augmented reality with IoT. Yeah. I mean, it's so
slick.
There's some neat stuff, and most of these are free. I think the one, so far as beginner courses I saw, the only one that cost anything was $9.
Not bad at all.
No, not really. So this is, it's a pretty cool little resource, just something for those of you guys that are interested. If you haven't really gotten into it yet, or you're not sure where to begin, here's a good starting point. You know, some of us, we just jump in and try to build the biggest, baddest thing we can. You know, and others like to ease their way in with a couple of courses and some beginner projects.
Well, the way I like to learn, you know, is I think Scott Hanselman or Rob Connery one talked about this is, you know, the equivalent of Hello World or getting an LED to flash.
Yes, yes.
Like that's your IoT Hello World. That's the way I tend to do my approach to things is get the simplest thing that can possibly work and then build out.
Yeah, my first IoT project was building a Raspberry Pi web server.
That actually was the attempt at doing that was mine as well. but okay, other than that example,
I'll start off with a quote from Alan Henry, and that is, critical thinking is an essential skill in our age of constant information and misinformation. But our own subconscious biases don't help matters much when it comes to sorting out truth from viral nonsense. And he put together a really great infographic that I found on Lifehacker about cognitive biases. There's 10 cognitive biases that you need to know. And if you guys have listened to our learning styles episode, you're probably kind of chuckling to yourself at me finding an infographic.
Yeah, not at all.
But so if you follow us on social media, which we are on Twitter and Facebook and Google Plus, we've talked about Buffer earlier. I buffered this infographic a few weeks back, so you may have already seen this, and so you can check that out, follow along. It'll also be in the show notes. Really, I liked the material so much that I kind of turned it into an episode, and I didn't use all 10. I kind of picked, well, all 10 would have taken too long. And so I kind of picked the ones that I thought were most relevant to the decisions that we make as programmers, or the ones that most likely are going to affect us as programmers. And like I said, this is not an exhaustive list.
So let's get into it.
So each day, we make upwards of 35,000 decisions. And there are many influences that affect our decision making.
Well, and let's also point out that a lot of times these biases are cognitive shortcuts.
Yes.
Like, you don't want to agonize over, you know, when to walk the dog in the morning. Like, the dog's got to go to the bathroom.
The dog lets you know when it's time to be
walked. You know, you're going to make a decision and it's going to be a mental shortcut. You probably have a habit around when you do that, and that's totally fine.
So. Unless the dog wakes up at 4:30 in the morning and starts licking your face, like what happened to me this morning, and I had to tell him, no, we'll go out when it's light out. And then I had to rub his belly till he went to sleep.
Well, anyway, so the first of these cognitive biases is the bandwagon effect and confirmation bias. And this is kind of like, this is kind of twofold.
Yeah, it's really two from the infographic, but they play together.
Yeah, very, very nicely.
Yeah, they play on each other so well. And
you see it on the internet all the time, right? You have echo chamber. Like, go to Tumblr.
Oh, my goodness.
There's some blogs there, like, these people have not had any contact with anybody that disagrees with them, ever.
Yeah.
And
so the bandwagon effect is believing or doing something because the people around you believe or do it. This is very similar to one of our favorite fantasy series, Sword of Truth, Wizard's First Rule, which is
people are stupid.
They'll believe anything they want to believe or are afraid of.
And you'll see the bandwagon effect en masse right now in the presidential election. I mean, as we're recording this, it's mid-April. And I'm not exactly sure when this episode comes out, but if it comes out before the election, and it will, you'll still be seeing this in effect. That's why we have all the polarization that we have, is the bandwagon effect and confirmation bias, because people are able to surround themselves with people who do not disagree with them. And so anything they see confirms what they think, what they thought was true.
Exactly. Yeah. The confirmation bias is basically prioritizing information that confirms an existing belief.
Yes. And we do that anyway.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
that's basically we're seeking information to support our own preconceptions.
Yes. I mean, that's pattern matching.
Yeah, it really is. And both of these, in a way, are popularity based.
Yes.
Because the popular opinion can make an item more desirable. I mean, look at Amazon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Gucci could paint three stripes on a piece of dog poop and sell it because it's Gucci.
Yes. You know,
that doesn't make it desirable. It's just that, hey, the crowd likes the stuff that this person puts out. So somebody's going to buy that.
You know, it's what's really funny. I was listening
to one of my exes.
I was listening to the MS Dev show, and I know I've talked about them a few times, or one of my favorite podcasts, but I was listening to them on the drive here the other day, and they were talking about their equipment, and they had just purchased podcast specific boxes, and they got the Mac Mini.
Yeah.
And they were talking about, you know, it was like talking about all the hype around it. And, you know, they went with it because, you know, it was a Mac and it had what they wanted. It was only $500 for a Mac. It's not too bad. It's like, you know, they really got about $300 worth of hardware.
Yeah.
But they paid an extra $200 for
the hype.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, so you'll see that in, you know, in a lot of consumer behavior. I mean, this is what internet marketing and any marketing really in general is built on.
Mm-hmm. They even have people that get paid for writing reviews on places like Amazon.
Yep.
Now, that's technically against their policy, and if you get caught doing it.
Yeah, you know, so they pay them a little extra not to get caught.
Yeah, exactly. It's also herd mentality.
Yeah. And you know, you got to think about it. Okay, the herd mentality, that sounds really bad. Think about a stampede. That is a herd mentality.
Yes.
Because people tend to go, oh, it's like a herd of cattle standing around. It's like, no, it's like a herd of cattle stampeding. You know, somebody's making them go somewhere and they don't even know where they're going. They just know that everybody else is.
Yeah. And if they don't move, they'll get run over.
Yep. Yeah. So you better move or you'll be another turd in the herd.
So you can avoid this by relying on, well,
by not really relying on anything. No. You get as much information as you can.
I was saying, not relying on popular opinions without considering kind of a broad range of opinions and weighing the available information. Because sometimes the only real information to decide between two things. I mean, this is about decision making, but let's say you're trying to decide between two different hard drives on Amazon. Well, you look at the detailed information and it's pretty much the same. Prices are pretty relatively similar. So the only thing you have to go on is the reviews.
Yeah, which are entirely subjective.
Yes. Now the trick here, and this is something that I've kind of picked up and I use, is whenever I'm looking at something on, especially on the internet, to buy, I'll look at the top reviews,
the bottom
reviews, and the bottom reviews.
Yep. And I do the same thing. And that has dramatically decreased the amount of broken and bad stuff that I buy.
Yeah. Most of the time on good products, like legitimately good products, the bad reviews are not bad reviews on the product. They're bad reviews on like the delivery or something.
I've noticed the same.
Yeah.
Which, is kind of troubling, but it's not really unsurprising in a hyper-connected world where anybody can have a voice and be anonymous.
Exactly.
Now, the next cognitive bias is reactance. And you and I talked about this a lot in college. We both really dislike the concept of a rebel without a cause.
Exactly.
Because it's just somebody intentionally being contrarian to be contrarian.
Yeah. It's
the opposite of the herd mentality.
Yeah.
Is really what it comes down to. And there's a phrase that somebody told me once that the opposite of crazy is also crazy.
You said that on the show before.
But I heard that somewhere and I can't remember where, but that always stuck with me as being.
You said that for years, man.
Really, really on point.
I can't even think back to when you started saying that because.
Yeah, it was.
You said it for so long.
It's been at least a decade, but this is absolutely true. And reactance is the opposite of that. It's going, hey, I'm going against the herd because they're all dumb. You know, let's find a popular TV show and let's trash talk it because everybody likes it.
Or in a business setting, this is wanting to do the opposite of what you paid a consultant to come in and tell you to do.
Yeah, or do the opposite of the rest of the market because you think you're Steve Jobs.
Yes. And it's not, you know, his success wasn't because he did the opposite of the market. It's because he did something innovative.
Well, and it's also because he didn't let, you know, he controlled when he went with the herd.
Yes. Very good point.
Because if you just go with the herd blindly, you're a cow. Mm-hmm. If you don't go with the herd at all, you get eaten by the wolves. If you go with the herd when it's smart to go with the herd, you're the cowboy. You're running the herd.
That's really good. I remember when, I guess it was high school, college era in my life, my dad referred to me as, you know, rebel without a cause. And I put a stop to that immediately.
Yeah, because
I said, no, I'm like, if I rebel against something, it's going to have a reason. Like, if I go along with something, it's because I agree with it.
Yeah.
It's not because everyone else is doing it.
Yeah. Sometimes compliance is assent.
Yes. Yes. And the trick to this is to leave ego at the door. Like, why are you rejecting the advice? Like, really ask yourself, why are you going against the herd? Is it for a good reason?
Yeah. Is it like you think the herd is wrong? I'll give you an example. In, I think it was early to mid 2008, I had quite a few people, including the lady that was cleaning our house at the time, tell me I should get into flipping houses. There was a lot of money in there. And I had so many people that I saw who were really living very bad financial lives, like making a lot of very dumb decisions, telling me this. And my thought process is, okay, I don't want to run with this herd because, first of all, I see where they run. And they're all going this way. Like there's a certain point when enough people that don't have their stuff together are all going in one direction that you got to go, you know, maybe I'm not going there. And that's not being a rebel without a cause. It's the idea that I, you know, ego wise, I have enough ego to go, yeah, this is a bad idea. Like I have enough self-respect to not just go along with it. but I also have enough self-respect to not go, oh, hey, the herd's running this way. Let me run the other way and short every real estate company in the world. Because if I'd taken that bet and said, okay, I'm going to short them, you know, I'm going to buy options for a month, for a month from now, because I'm sure they'll be tanked. Well, it wasn't tanked until October, give or take. I think it was October. It was, you know, it was a little while after that. Like, I saw it coming, but I couldn't figure out the timeline. So I had enough ego to go, get away from this mess, but don't go the
exact opposite. Yeah. And this is also being a rebel with a cause, you know, having a reason to go against the herd is okay. You know,
well, and I feel this way every time I discuss object relational mapping because I don't like doing it.
Yeah.
And I have very,
I have very good reasons for not. Like, I've talked to you about this.
Yeah. And we should do it. You know, we can probably do a podcast on why that is. Why I'm,
let's do that.
You know, not necessarily dead set against it, but most of the time I feel like it's an incorrect approach because I've, you know, honestly, I've been smacked in the face by it because I used to really like them. But, you know, you figure it out and you heard enough.
Next, we have availability heuristic. This is an overestimation of the importance of easily recalled information.
Yeah, and I can give you a pretty good example of that, right? We'll see things in the news media. Well, let's look at the terrorism phenomenon, right? Mm-hmm. You have terrorism, school shootings, those kind of things, right? People remember those. But they don't remember that, hey, you know, New York had this many shootings in a day or Chicago had this many shootings in a day that were completely unrelated to that. But yeah. I easily recall the fact that a school shooting happened or that, you know, some kind of terrorist activity happened and ignore the other mass of data that I probably don't remember because it's common or it just didn't make the news.
Yeah.
And this can very much skew your decision on anything because you could, you know, like I've seen the you know, the stereotyping of Muslims over this. And it's because people easily recall terrorism by some Muslims. And, you know, they don't recall that, hey, you know, everybody's kind of being crap to each other right now.
Yeah, that's not something,
you know, you have those biases. And the thing is it makes people make dumb decisions because, you know, you can have Muslim friends. If, I mean, honestly, there's 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. If they were all violent jihadis, you'd know it.
That is a very good point on that. I've heard a lot of arguments on both sides of that. Well, heard. I've read them on Facebook, to be honest. But
I've heard both sides of the argument. And
yeah,
it's one of those things that's like, okay, I can remember that something happened, but because that was an emotional reaction and it stuck more, it gets more weight than something that's, you know, that was equally atrocious, honestly, that got no attention whatsoever because it didn't emotionally impact me.
Yeah, exactly. This is the immediate examples that come to mind, and that can be perceived threats or related events. So when you're making a decision about something, if you relate it to another decision, there's a tendency to give higher value to that remembered decision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the same reason I ask, you know, I've done this a few times and this is going to sound skeezy too. But you ask somebody for something small before you ask them for something big.
Yeah. You said that before on here.
Because it works like a champ. And it's because you're tying that, you're anchoring their compliance with a simple decision to their compliance with a larger decision.
Yes. Yes. That makes perfect sense.
Now, the thing is you can also do this to yourself way easier than anybody else can because your own mind will match that pattern.
Mm-hmm. And so to try and avoid this when you are making a decision, substitute intuition with data because we can easily rely too much on our own intuition, but we really need to assess the data, the information before making each decision.
Yeah. And like although we said, sometimes your intuition is the data. Right. Like
that's,
if it's an
true.
Emotional decision, like let's say that you're in a relationship and, you know, like let's say it's a relationship with a friend and the friend is constantly making you feel denigrated and you're having to deal with that. Well, somebody goes, well, most of the time the data says that your friend doesn't make you feel like that. But you're like, I it's really bad now. Well, what do you do? Well, if you follow the data as, you know, part of the data is your intuition.
And that's very true. And that's the thing. It's
But if you think that you're, if you're making a decision based on intuition, you need to seek hard data.
Yeah. Thing is, don't rely solely on intuition, or you may fall into the trap of the availability heuristic.
Yeah, you will. It's just whether you get away with it or not.
Mm-hmm.
That really comes down to it. And most of these things are that way too, right? You can go with the herd most of the time.
Yeah.
And you won't be too bad off, right? You might have to listen to some Nickelback.
Well, you know, the herd is making fun of Nickelback, so.
Yeah.
So if you really want to rebel against something, well, be a Nickelback fan.
I don't know. If you're, you know, if you're looking at the money that band's making, there's a herd there too. There's true. Two herds at least. Yeah. Now, the next one is the Dunning-Kruger effect. And you've actually got a quote here from Bertrand Russell.
Yeah. One of the painful things about our time is that those who feel certainty are stupid, and those with any imagination and understanding are filled with doubt and indecision.
It's like I was talking about with Occam's razor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is supposed to handle the suggestions of the not the absolute dumbest person in the room.
It's meant to not overcomplicate things.
Right.
Not to say the simplest suggestion is the best. What this is, the Dunning-Kruger effect, is basically unskilled individuals have a tendency to overestimate their own abilities.
At a place where I worked, there was a previous developer that I didn't ever meet who would always, you know, tell management, you know, hey, I'm a rock star developer and I'm a 10X developer and, you know, all these different things, you know. And, you know, the guy had at least 10 years of experience, and he was about what somebody should be at 3 years. And a lot of that was because he overestimated. Like, you know, it's one of those things where the value of a cup isn't the fact that it's a cup, it's that it's empty.
So I got a question for you. This is something I know I talked about a little bit earlier, talking to recruiters, but a lot of them have asked me lately to assess my skill level on a scale of 1 to 10.
I hate that because they're like, well, assess your skill level at C sharp on a scale of 1 to 10. And I say 8, and you know, the kind of stuff I do.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's also the, you also have a bit of an availability heuristic problem too, because as you get better, who do you notice more?
The people better than you.
Yeah. And so you think everybody's better.
Yeah.
And
that, it's something that, like, I had to deal with this today on the phone, and I asked, I'm like, all right, well, what is the scale? Is this a scale of 1 to 10 for a junior developer?
Yeah.
Or is this a scale of 1 is I know nothing about development, and
10 is I'm Anders Hjelsberg.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I wrote the compiler and
it's like
the whole thing. It's like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's like you got to tell me what this scale is, because otherwise I don't know where to place myself. If it's a scale of 1 to 10 on junior
Here's
developers,
the honest truth.
I'll be a lot higher than if it's a scale of 1 to 10 on all developers.
Here's the honest truth. What that scale is how well can I be cocky at what I think I know? That's not how they're using it, but that's how it's going to come out.
Wait, from my end or from their end? Like, if I say a lower number, they can go, oh, well, I pretend to know more, or is it I'm being cocky about how much I know?
It's an opportunity for you to be cocky. Like, it doesn't measure anything. And I've had this conversation with recruiters before.
So I should be telling them higher than I'm saying.
You know, say like 5 or 6, depending on where you are, you know, but part of the deal is there's no real metric there, because, you know, depending on what you're doing, like, I've done a lot of, you know, graphics programming in C#, and I don't run into people that do that around here.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can tighten stuff up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
On that, does that make me a 10? Well, okay, turn around. Like doing, you know, dealing with cryptography stuff, I don't do much with that. I do a little. Does that make me a 1 at that? When I can do it, it's just I never have to. I mean, like, that's not a good scale. And
yeah,
and this almost that scale is built around presumptions about the model that don't work, which is also where we are with this whole Dunning-Kruger effect thing.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up, because it flowed into this. And honestly, I was going to mention it in the intro, but then I forgot. We got to talking about other things and it came up in my mind here, and it flew with it. I mean, it's a failure to adequately assess competence.
Yeah, well, you're you know, the thing is you cannot self-assess.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you just it's not doable. It's like having one mirror and being able to see the back of your own head.
Okay? I could do that with my phone.
Yeah. You're going to have to do something hacky, and you're never going to get a clear shot of that.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
And so that's what this is. Sometimes it's also very possible to know enough to get in trouble. And this is something I see junior devs do all the time because they know that the way you're doing this is wrong.
Well, you know what? It's interesting because when I was first learning to code, I didn't recognize this back in high school.
Yeah.
Because I was 16, 17 years old. And there's been research that's shown that the area of the brain,
the frontal cortex.
Yeah.
It's not really grown in good yet.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And the area that...
That was on NPR very recently. They were talking about drug use in teenagers and how it does more damage because... Yeah.
And how the area that takes more risk is...
Not suppressed.
Yes, exactly.
And so what does that make you do? That makes you overestimate your skill. But then the other side of it comes as you get older, you underestimate.
Yeah. And that's the corollary to this is experts often underestimate. And it's a thing that we've talked about here. We ought to really do an entire episode on the imposter syndrome.
Yeah, because that's very serious. Like, I feel that all the time. Like, you know, I get that at work a lot of times, even if I'm doing difficult stuff and doing it well. A lot of days I'm still sitting there waiting for somebody to go, you know, we knew you weren't any good at this.
Yeah.
And it's a very surreal thing because, well, you know, the thing is you have that bias. You have the availability heuristic going on there. You remember your mistakes, but other people don't.
You know, it's really funny. It's, I enjoy coming over here and talking to you because you have a fairly accurate representation of my ability. Yeah. And like, I'll get to going on something on my own and think, you know, I am just the greatest CSS coder ever. And then I'll show stuff to you and you're like, yeah, you could have done this better. You could have done this better. I'm like, man.
Yeah.
And then I'll have a day where I do like this grueling technical assessment or something or technical interview. And I'll come in and I'll talk to you and you're like, that's like something I couldn't answer. You're smart enough to dance, to do that and stuff like that. And so it's like, yeah. You know,
it's like we're in a profession that is very difficult to measure and it's impossible to self-measure anyway. And we're trying to stack the probability of being right on both of those.
Exactly.
And if you take two probabilities, right, like two events are going to occur, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of them has a probability of X and one of them has a probability of Y. What's the probability that they're both going to occur? It's less than either of those.
Yeah. No.
That's the situation we find ourselves. It's just not.
What I was getting at was this is a place where others' opinions can be useful, especially others that you respect, that you know are going to be objective, and objective methods to assess our own skill, such as assessment tools like tests and exercises, can kind of help with this.
They can. Of course, they can also be horribly wrong.
That's true.
But yeah, and I guess this gets into the, you know, the next thing is really there's orders of ignorance.
Yeah.
And there's different levels to it. Because if I know that I don't know something, that's first order ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And that at least, that's pretty easy to cure because, I don't know something. In other words, I don't have this piece of knowledge. Where do I go get it?
Yeah.
Like that's easily solvable. But
that's something that I've noticed in a lot of interviews, just for the other junior devs out there, that even if you don't know everything, being first order ignorant and knowing where to go look for something, a lot of interviewers that I've talked to have liked that.
Well, yeah, because they know that you're not going to know everything going in. Even a senior developer from the same industry working on a competing product doesn't know everything. Because there's going to be something very slightly different and they'll have never seen it before.
Yeah. Well, one thing that really threw me was they asked in an interview what I do when I don't, you know, when I have a problem or something. I said, yeah, I told them, like, I've worked with you. Kind of the way you trained me was try and figure it out on your own and then bring it to a senior dev if you can't.
Yeah.
You know, and show them what you've done. Well, I was like, you know, and they say, okay, so what do you do? And I was like, well, normally I'll start off going to Stack Overflow, MSDN, and, you know, a few other places. And you know, they just kind of looked at me and like, you know about Stack Overflow? I'm like, yeah, I thought everybody did.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, to me, that wasn't a big thing that junior devs didn't know. That was just to first, yeah. You know, usually first or second result in a Google search.
Yeah.
And I sort of like clung to it because it kept coming up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and they also have trained a lot of developers not to do that because people mindlessly copy code from there and sometimes it doesn't work. And the other thing, too, is if you're from my generation of coders, we didn't have Stack Overflow. We had Experts Exchange, which is a very unfortunate domain name if all the letters are crammed together like it was back then. They put a dash in there between expert and our experts and exchange, but initially that's not what it was. And when that shows up in a firewall log, people ask a lot of questions. But so second order ignorant means not knowing that you don't know. This is where most people have a problem.
Yes, because they don't know something and they don't know that they're ignorant of it.
Right. And the thing is it's very easy to remain ignorant.
Yeah, because you don't know that you're ignorant. You don't know you need to go out and learn something when you don't know.
Well, you probably, it's not that you don't know that you don't know. It's that you know something that isn't.
And then, of course, there's third order ignorant, and that's not knowing that there's anything there to begin with.
Yeah.
And then fourth order ignorant is, you know.
Just dumb, I guess. Like, they don't really classify it. I don't think I've ever seen it even classified up to third order ignorant.
Yeah, I made honestly. Up third order ignorant.
Yeah.
I thought we would be kind of heavy at this point in the podcast, so I threw something funny in.
So I guess the way we would put it is you and I are third order ignorant about fourth order ignorance.
Yes.
If we want to take it to the meta.
There we go. That's it. That's
straight
it.
To the meta.
All right. Moving right along, we have the curse of knowledge. And that is the difficulty in seeing a problem from a less knowledgeable perspective.
And I'll give you an example of this.
This is why Will is not suffer from this, because he does great with examples and he is a really good teacher.
There's a comic called XKCD.
I love that comic. I love that place.
And there's these two nerds discussing, and they're like, well, we can use, you know, I think it was 4096-bit encryption, and they'll never be able to guess the password, and, you know, even with a multi-million-dollar computer, and we'll be totally fine. And then I think further on in the same comic strip, there's one of the guys is tied to a chair, and somebody says, well, we can't crack the password with this million-dollar computer, so hit him with his $5 wrench until he gives it up. And it's the mindset of not thinking about the less informed perspective that just goes, well,
I told you I love that comic. I'm going to try and find it so I can include it. I've included, anytime I've mentioned XKCD, I've.
Yeah, you really just need to subscribe to that, because there's so many tech things that they really just nail.
Yeah, it's
and
it's
that was great. A very good one. It's just,
I just love that it started what he was in college, just doodling.
Yeah.
And it started around the same time we were in college. Wasn't it?
It's been around a long time.
So like back when you and I were writing long diatribes for the underground newsletter at our college.
This guy's like making succinct little comics that just are way better.
Yes, way better than what we wrote. Anyways, so our very first episode was talking to non-technical coworkers and bosses. And that's what we covered, was the curse of knowledge. This is also great, and Will just gave us the perfect example in what he said, in him saying it, which is teaching or mentoring junior developers in avoid making assumptions about their knowledge base. Give the context via examples. Or something that he's done with me a lot when I have not understood something was to begin with the basics and build up. Outward. And the great thing about doing that is you start with the basics. Especially if you're talking to a broad audience or someone you don't know where their level of knowledge is, you start with the basics. And if they know about that, it turns into a conversation. And then as you get more complex, the conversation grows. Next is the framing effect. And this is basically when the same information is presented in a different manner, people will draw different conclusions.
Well, this is used in surveys all the time.
Oh, like surveys. Load
questions or in court.
This is used a lot in politics and media. And it's basically how the material is presented creates an emotional reaction.
Yes.
You know, this is also used, you mentioned surveys, but it's also used as test validation in a lot of psychological testing. Like, if you take the full MMPI, or even one that people are probably more familiar with, the Myers-Briggs, like, there's tons of online tests, but if you take the full version, you're going to answer the same question four or five times, written a little bit differently, and the point is to show validity, to show that you are consistent across the board.
Yeah, just to get the
you're not just the randomly bias out. Yeah, you're not just randomly filling in letters or. But the way to avoid this is look for the meaning of the information presented. Look at what they're trying to say, and then you can step back and kind of see, okay, they're presenting it this way to get this emotional reaction, and you see a little bit of the intent of the person presenting the information. And finally, we have the anchoring effect. This is focusing on the first piece or the most prominent piece of information received.
Yeah, and you'll also see this a lot in the media too, because I don't know if you've noticed how news stories break, but they break and there's all kinds of inaccurate information that comes out. And then 6 months later, you know, it was proved to be wrong within like a day, but 6 months later, people will still be repeating the same thing because they heard it first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and a lot of times that's used to push agendas.
Yeah, especially very questionable agendas. And it's also used in corporate settings.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like delivering news about how things are going, you'll see a lot of, especially if your company is starting to kind of skate onto thin ice, you'll see them issuing things that go, oh yeah, the company's good, everything's fine, and you know they'll be loudly talking about it, and then two or three days later you see a stock market correction on it, and nobody really pays a whole lot of attention to the second value of that, and that's how they keep employees around, because they know that, hey, the smack in the face from the invisible hand is coming, so they try to say, we've never been hit in the face.
Yeah, on a more, I guess, personal or smaller level, you'll see this a lot in price negotiation.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people can be swayed. Most people, even. That's why it works. Most people can be swayed if they feel they're getting a bargain. Yeah. This is the whole concept behind the sticker price on cars at dealerships, because sticker price is never the actual price of the car.
Right.
I mean, the actual price is a lot lower. The sticker price is to make you feel like
You're getting a deal. Well, because otherwise, if they actually put the real price on there, you would talk them under what they need. And so it's a game theory thing, right? Out of a population of people, there's going to be basically a curve of where those people would price that vehicle. And what you want to do is you want to set the right side of the curve so that you move the middle.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now,
that's a very visual representation. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
It works for me and probably works for a few other people, but I'll give you an example.
Well, and we misprice things, right? I mean, going back to the whole economy thing right now, a large percentage of the population is not very good at setting the value of the things that they're receiving. So they overpay because they're setting it to someone else's value.
Yes. And
the idea of price, the economics of price is that price will be as high as the market will bear. If the market is not accurately reflecting price, the market will bear a lot of price.
Yeah, that's
See the diamond industry.
Yeah, that's a great point right there. And the idea here is focus on the value base of an item when you're making a decision, especially about pricing. What I was getting at earlier, back to the car reference, was when I bought my truck, we went in and we looked up the price of the truck, like on Kelley Blue Book, like what it should cost for, you know, the amount of usage it had and stuff like that. And so when we went in to negotiate, we told them, we gave them a fair value. You know, we gave them the above what the trade-in value was, but well below what the sticker price was, well below what they wanted to sell it at. But it was still enough where they're making money, because we're realistic. They're not going to sell it if they're not going to make money on it.
Right. Well, and if you think about what markets actually are, do you remember the herd mentality thing we were talking about?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a value proposition. And what happens when you follow the herd is someone else is setting your value. In other words, they're saying, hey, there's a predator over here. Hey, there's food over here.
Well, the right. What they're used to is playing this game where they get you the vehicle that you want and you'll do whatever it takes because you have to convince them to let you buy it. That is not the case.
Right.
They have to convince you to buy it. And so...
Well, it's called flipping the script.
Yeah. My ex-wife and I went in and we sat down at the salesman's desk and got our computers out, plugged them in. We told him the price we were willing to pay, and then we started studying. He went back to his manager, because that's the way they play the game. They go to their manager. Actually, they really, my dad was in the car industry. They go back there and they, you know, have a cup of coffee and stuff, and then they come back out with a higher offer. And we just told him, we're like, nope, this is what we said. You take as much time as you need. We're just going to sit here and study and then go to Starbucks when we're done here. And, you know, free coffee there, so better for us. So we kept studying, and the next time he came back, he gave us the exact thing we wanted, the exact offer we wanted, because he knew we were going to waste his time. He could make another sale in the time it would take him to go back and forth, and we weren't going to budge because we had set up shop in his office.
Well, and you also flipped the script as well, because instead of him being able to say, I'm the one setting the value here, you're going, no, you're not, because I'm the one with the money.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what we did. And we did that for her truck when we bought it. And then we did that for my truck when we bought it. And now,
imagine this situation, if you will, in the context of negotiating a salary. Developers are chronically underpriced.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that phrase probably made somebody just swerve off the road just now. If you're managing and you're seeing what that costs. But think about it. If you're hiring a developer and you're actually using their abilities, you should be able to generate quite a bit more income off of one developer's ability if it's used judiciously than you're actually paying.
Yes. And this is an interesting thing because I've been having a lot of these conversations with companies and with recruiters as I've been interviewing. And one thing that I found interesting, one of the recruiters, when she asked me what I was looking for salary range, and I told her, she's like, wow, that's actually, that makes sense. She's like, that's what the company's offering too. And I'm like, I'm trying to be realistic here. I'm like, I don't want to, like, if I ask for a whole lot more, it's not going to be we negotiate down. It's going to be they go with somebody else.
Yeah.
Because it's easier on them. If I ask for the range, somewhere in the range that they are offering.
Now you get to have a conversation.
Yes.
But you do want to be at the high end.
Oh, yeah.
Because they will try to negotiate you down. And I think of course, I've been through several, I've been through a few positions where, like, I quoted what I thought was an obscene figure. And I've had one or two of them go, oh, we'll go 10 grand over that, which completely throws you when that happens, because you're like, wow, I really, you know, and the thing is they got more value out of me than that. And I was misaligning my value. It's very easy to do.
Mm-hmm. And that goes right back to some of the other stuff we talked about with the Dunning-Kruger effect and the availability heuristic. I mean, these all really tie in together, but we are starting to kind of run low on time. So before we wrap things up, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, to go with the Dunning-Kruger effect here a little bit, I just want to have a little quip here that I've I forget exactly where I picked it up, but we'll find it. Do you know what is harder, writing code or debugging code?
Debugging code. We've had this conversation.
So if you write the code as cleverly as possible, by definition, what happens?
You cannot debug it.
That's right. Now, the point of this is not to necessarily make the code simpler than it has to be. But the point of this is that you have to write it in a way that you can follow and that other people can follow. So sometimes that new whiz bang pattern thing that you're trying to do isn't going to work because you're not ready or your team is not ready, or it inhibits your ability to reason, even if it decouples.
That makes sense. I think I see how this goes along with the Dunning-Kruger effect is you have for that to be effective and to be able to put that into proper effect, what you're saying, you have to be able to get an accurate assessment of yourself and your team.
Right.
Because if you have an inaccurate assessment, you'll either write code that is too simplistic for what it needs to do, or
like
too
the
complex.
File parsing routine I just dealt with, that was to deal with comma separated values that are dumped out of Excel. They said, oh, we'll just take it line by line and split it on the commas. Well, that's great, except Excel puts quotes around each field. And if there's a comma between two quotes, it's not a split.
No.
But they just did a straight up string split because it was the simplest thing it could possibly work.
Yeah. I've seen stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, I've written stuff like that. It's very easy to do. And that's really where this effect comes in, because one thing that you will see a lot of senior developers do as they, you know, as they mature from the mid-level, like you go into mid-level and you start making things really, really complicated. And then at some point, it's just you start cutting the crap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you know you're kind of, I wouldn't say it's on a down, you know, downhill slide towards being a senior developer.
Well, that makes perfect sense, because you see that not just in development, but in most specialized fields.
Yeah, well, you see it in martial arts too, right? You start learning, and what happens? Well, you do the basics, right? And then at the mid-level, you start doing more and more complex things. And then what do you see the old masters doing?
The basics.
Every day.
Yeah.
The basics. And they will hit you with a punch from the first kata. And it hurts so bad.
Yes.
It's not because they're, you know, it's not necessarily that they've mastered every punch. It's that, hey, this one works really well, and that's why it was in the basics.
Uh-huh.
And turns out that it still works.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it really does. So that's kind of something I want to push here a little bit, is if you're past junior level and you're into mid level, I mean, at junior level, you're going to have to go up in complexity just so you know. It's almost like knowing what the rules are so that you can then simplify.
Mm-hmm. Don't try to short circuit it.
Right. Because the reason you know that a particular movement is wasted is because you have wasted it.
Yes.
At some point.
And
that doesn't mean forcefully make mistakes either. It just means that it's part of the curve. So if you're at the point where you can't learn any more stuff, then now's the time that you figure out how to do more with less. So that's all I got. If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.